Good morning, Radio Sinoland fans. This is Jeff in Beijing on International Labor Day, May 1st. Today I'm going to talk about a fascinating subject that I know you're going to find incredibly interesting and informative. And the title of it is Mao Zedong, Ow or Wow? And in researching 44 Days and then Reflections in Sinoland and now Xi Jinping's Red Letters, I keep coming across what psychologists call cognitive dissonance. And that is when your mind is grappling with two conflicting ideas simultaneously. On the one hand is Western media, books, and textbooks describing Mao Zedong as everything from the devil incarnate to the world's bloodthirstiest butcher and on, versus Xi Jinping's and the people of China's undying pride and loyalty to this same said person. And whether you love him or hate him, he truly was a giant on history's 20th century stage. So I kept asking myself, if Mao was such a depraved, demonic, diabolical fiend who brought China to its knees and destroyed its nation's people, why do the Chinese love him so much? I've talked to thousands of Chinese over my nearly 12 years here, and lots of them vent their spleen at the Communist Party, the corruption, the hypocrisy, just like Westerners mock their political parties and process. I've heard Chinese criticize Deng and Jiang and Hu, China's post-Mao leaders, for all kinds of reasons. Too much of this, too little of that. I can find Chinese today who criticize Xi Jinping, although usually it's for not doing enough to clean up the party's politics. And yes, I've talked to a handful of Chinese who don't like Mao. They're usually the ones who suffered, if they're older, or whose parents suffered during the Cultural Revolution. But through it all, I can safely say that about 98% of the Chinese I've talked to like Mao and what he did for China. His image adorns taxi cabs like an amulet of St. Christopher, you know, to ward off accidents. He's on walls of privately owned offices and restaurants, so these are not government. These are people who have decided to do this on their own. He's everywhere. How can this be in the face of relentless demonization by Western media, educators, historians, and politicians? So I started to do my research, and here's what I found out. You have to understand where China was in 1949 when Mao became leader of the New People's Republic. In 1949, China was basically a 19th century country. There was rural starvation, which was endemic, you know, over many areas of the country. 25% of the adult population was addicted to opium, up to 100 million people. Due to generalized misery, there was prostitution and child trafficking, which were rampant because people did not have enough money and food to survive. There was almost no industrial capacity in Chinese hands. It was all owned by Western and Japanese colonialists and occupiers. Electricity was a luxury for the vast majority of citizens, even in many big cities. 80% of the people could not read or write. Think about that, only 20% literacy. Millions of children died or were handicapped every year from many diseases since there was no immunization program. Infrastructure had been largely ignored for 100 years, except for what was useful to the Western and Japanese colonialists to import opium and export silver and goods. And get a load of this. In 1949, a Chinese citizen could expect to live an average of only 35 years. Furthermore, for the females of the world, women were little more than chattel property, and the cruelty of feet binding was still common. So here was China, which until 1872 was the world's largest economy and historically one of the most technologically advanced, after unwise policy decisions during the Ming Dynasty and 100 years of brutal colonial exploitation and war, had reduced to a social and economic and political 19th century basket case, the country of China. That was the China that Mao took over in 1949. So after doing extensive research, including sleuthing in museums here in Beijing, this is what I found out. Under the direction of Mao, in only 30 years, from 1949 to 1978, which we can call the Mao era, the Communist Party of China used its centralized socialist authority, organizing human and natural resources, and developed industrial and civilian infrastructure, thereby turning China from a 19th century hellhole into a 20th century country. And to give you some background on that, to wit, Mao and the CPC, which stands for the Communist Party of China, eradicated opium use, prostitution, child slavery, and child trafficking in only 2 years, saving tens of millions of lives. When Deng took over after Mao's death and started to implement his far-sighted economic and social reforms, decent roads connected most cities and towns on a provincial basis. Using local grids and constructing more than 10,000 hydroelectric dams, which I've seen in my travels, over 60% of the people had access to electricity, including remote and low-income rural areas. Incredibly, the nation's literacy rate reached two-thirds of all the people and 80% of school children, school-aged youth, one of the highest levels among developing countries at that time. And this was done in the world's most populous nation. It is now, of course, virtually 100%. The majority of the masses were immunized, including almost all babies at 1 year of age. Life expectancy skyrocketed from 35 years of age to 65 years of age. It is now 76 years, at about the same level as Eastern Europe. Although still very patriarchal, women's status was modernized. Women doctors, lawyers, teachers, engineers. Women gained free choice over their bodies. And now to put some numbers on some of this, Mao, during his era from 1949 to 1978, increased China's gross domestic product by 600%, increased China's grain production 300% from 100 million metric tons to 300 million metric tons, increased rail lines 266% from 23,000 kilometers to 60,000 kilometers, increased passenger train traffic 750% from 103 million passengers to 815 million passengers, increased, even more spectacularly, increased rail freight tonnage from 56 million metric tons to 1.1 billion metric tons. Increased the road network 1,000% from 80,000 kilometers to 800,000 kilometers. Steel production went from virtually zero, which was destroyed during World War II, to 35 million metric tons per year. Postal and telecommunications increased 800% from 600 million to 48 billion letters, calls, telegrams, etc. I think they're called communication units. The population increased 57% from 542 million to 956 million citizens. Now, to put that in perspective, from 1840 to 1949, the population only increased from 413 million to 542 million due to all the drug addiction, misery, and colonial economic exploitation. In other words, the population almost didn't grow during the previous 100 years. All of this was done while being totally shut out from the world economy and commerce by America's brutal blockade, like what they've done to Cuba. So this is what we Westerners need to understand. Without these impressive accomplishments and development, Deng's reforms would have failed starting in 1978. Just as importantly, without Mao's inspiration and struggle for the people of China to stand up and be free, after really 110 years of Western and Japanese exploitation, Deng's reforms would have been for the benefit of foreign powers, banks, and Wall Street, and not for the Chinese people. Plenty of countries around the world have been consumed and lost their sovereignty to globalization, Western debt, or had their governments overthrown by the West. Thanks to Mao, the Chinese have been and continue to control their destiny and resources, both human and natural. And their opening up to the world economy is for the masses' benefit, not Uncle Sam's. There are very few non-Western countries that can say this. Putin's Russia now also being can now be included in along with China. People forget that one of Joseph McCarthy's biggest PR weapons back in post-war America, you remember that demagogue, don't you, was to accuse President Harry Truman of losing China to Mao and the communists, and viciously attacking Eisenhower for not standing up to Mao and his communists to get China back. Think about that. You don't lose something if you don't think that you already owned it. And you can't take something back unless you feel that it's yours to be had. This was and still is the West's attitude about China, to be owned and exploited. To this day, China's political and economic independence is what Washington, London, and Paris cannot accept, and why they are so committed to overthrowing the government here. Instead of a Mao or a Xi Jinping, they want to install a Western puppet leader and government like Boris Yeltsin in 90s Russia or Poroshenko in today's Ukraine. Without Mao's legacy, that scenario would have surely already happened a long time ago, as it has in most non-Western countries around the world. So this is why the Chinese officially say that Mao was right 70% of the time and made mistakes 30% of the time. Now that we reviewed the 70% good, let's take a look at the 30% bad. And in order to do that, again, you have to look at some background and some history. First, Mao was a committed revolutionary. There's no doubt about that. Here's three quotes by him that kind of, you know, confirm this. One of his, political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. Another one that he was quoted at in his little red book, a revolution is not a dinner party or writing an essay or painting a picture or doing embroidery. It cannot be so refined, so leisurely and gentle, so temperate, kind, courteous, restrained, and magnanimous. A revolution is an insurrection, an act of violence by which one class overthrows the other. And then there's the other one that I found during my research for Xi Jinping's diaries that I'm writing about the 1952 meeting he had. That was where he told Xi Jinping's father, who was China's Secretary General of the State Council, working with very closely with Zhou Enlai and other high-level leaders, that to keep the revolution strong, they needed to kill one person out of 1,000 to 2,000 citizens. In other words, set an example for everyone else by getting rid of those who were against the cause. While at first glance this may seem shocking and bloodthirsty, it is not out of the norm. The French Revolution was a bloody affair. The American Revolution was a bloody affair. By necessity, revolution is a mighty battle between the rich and the poor, the have and the have-nots, the bankers and the citizens, the government tyrants versus the oppressed citizens. Just to give you an example, here's a few quotes from some American luminaries. President Abraham Lincoln said, Americans can exercise their constitutional right of amending it, in other words, the government, or their revolutionary right to dismember or overthrow it. In other words, you're not going to overthrow the government and dismember it and completely change it without some violence and death. Super patriot Patrick Henry said, "We must fight. I repeat it, sir, we must fight. An appeal to arms." That sounds like Mao to me. And then, another, of course, his most famous one, by Patrick Henry. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. And, of course, that meant, you know, killing a few people along the way. President Thomas Jefferson said, "And what country can preserve its liberties if its rulers are not warned from time to time that this people preserve the spirit of resistance," which, of course, can mean revolution. "Let them take arms." Sounds like Mao, doesn't it? "The remedy is to set them right as to the facts, pardon and pacify them." All right, they're talking about pacifying the leaders. "What signify a few lives lost in a century or two? The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. It is its natural manure." That was President Thomas Jefferson, and Mao Zedong could not have said it any better. He also said, Thomas Jefferson, "I hold it that a little rebellion," of course, revolution, "now and then is a good thing and is necessary in the political world. It is a medicine necessary for the sound health of government." And then that historical radical Thomas Paine said, "We have in our power to begin the world over again." Of course, what is a revolution? Starting something completely new. Talking about a revolution like John Lennon. Martin Luther King, who was also calling for a hope for a peaceful revolution, famously said, "The greatest purveyor of violence in the world, my own government. I cannot be silent." Of course, he was killed by his own government for speaking revolutionary power, truth to power. And outside the United States, this quote, "A revolution is an idea taken up by bayonets." That was Napoleon Bonaparte getting back to the French Revolution. And then America's good buddy Fidel Castro down in Cuba, "A revolution is not a bed of roses. A revolution is a struggle between the future and the past." And, of course, in other words, the past are the have-nots taking what is rightfully theirs in the future. So think about this. In a historical context, a proper historical context, Mao's vision of violent revolution was not so outrageous and obscene as it seems. In fact, it was very mundane and mainstream. Now, knowing that Mao was a bread-and-butter revolutionary, and a long line of proud, principled rebels, let's take a look at the two events which have tarnished his image at home and given so much propaganda fodder to Western talking heads abroad. And, of course, the first one was the Great Leap Forward. And for those of you who don't know what the Great Leap Forward was, 1958 to 1961, Mao and the government tried to do collectivization of agriculture and essentially collectivization of industry too, and it didn't work. And I think we can all agree that forced collectivization does not work. Stalin did it in the USSR and it failed. Mao tried it in China and it failed. And when I was in Africa back in the 80s, a lot of people don't know this, but it was tried in Tanzania and Ethiopia and it was a big failure. Ah, fireworks going off for May Day. Enjoy it. Of course, one of the biggest historical blueprints for all these collectivization failures was Andrew Jackson's 1930 Indian Removal Act, which is brushed over in Western history books, which basically codified the genocide of millions of Native Americans. America's Gulag and Indian reservations have been and are a colossal failure for the small percentage of natives who survived Euro-American extermination. So collectivization doesn't work whether it's in the United States, whether it's in Europe, or whether it's in Asia. Not only is forced collectivization a bad idea, but Mao and company unluckily tried it during one of China's worst droughts in the previous 100 years. The Chinese say about 16.5 million died. Westerners say somewhere between 18 million and 45 million. Let's take the average of these, which is 26.5 million, and let's just round it up to 30 million, you know, for people who say to eliminate any bias. In 1958, when the Great Leap Forward started, China's population was 654 million, about half of today's 1.37 billion. So 30 million is 4.6% of the total population. Sounds like a lot, doesn't it? But how does this compare to other tragedies in the not-so-distant world history? Well, France lost 5% of its population during World War I. Ireland lost 15% of its population due to the Great Famine Genocide in 1845 to 1853, which was enforced by their British masters. Totally preventable, but they legislated that great famine. French colonialists in Vietnam, during a terrible drought, caused 2 million to starve to death in 1945 in Vietnam, 9% of the population. The U.S. killed 7% of the people starting in 1898, colonizing the Philippines via induced famine and disease, you know, the standard colonial roadmap, burning crops and villages, blowing up dams and irrigation systems, poisoning drinking water, etc., infecting the people with diseases they had no immunity for. I could go on all day about Western-induced famines in India, Asia, Africa, and the Americas going back 500 years, with whopping percentages of the local population decimated every time. So in historical perspective, yes, 5% of the Chinese population lost during the Great Leap Forward was a tragedy, which the Chinese officially accept, but it is by no means unusual as an event, nor is its magnitude. Mao and company simply proved once more that forced collectivization is bad socioeconomic policy. However, after 110 years of Western colonization, where China's population only grew 0.7% per year, a total of 128 million over 110 years, China's population grew 57%, or 415 million more citizens from 1949 to 1978. So in only one generation, it grew that much. So Mao's Great Leap Forward cost China 30 million citizens, but his other policies increased the population by 415 million. Now let's take a look at the Cultural Revolution. Another failed socio-political project, you know, was the Cultural Revolution, and there are many in world's history. I mean, you know, the West socio-political projects in Iraq, Syria, and Libya, where millions have been killed since 1990, come to mind. Not much to say here. The Cultural Revolution, as well as all of these other catastrophes that have been caused by the United States in the Middle East, North Africa, etc., the Cultural Revolution was a bad idea that spiraled out of control. It is true that Mao, you know, he launched the Cultural Revolution in part to keep his political rivals off balance after losing so much face and suffering so much criticism for the failures of the Great Leap Forward. In researching 44 Days and Reflections in Sinoland and now Red Letters, I know a whole generation suffered the consequences. But again, in the context of the Mao era's socioeconomic achievements, not to mention in comparison the West's ongoing disasters around the world, it puts things in perspective that few Westerners are willing to acknowledge. While the West has so successfully, what the West has done so successfully is to keep the world's attention focused on the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution, and then later, of course, Tiananmen, and to completely ignore the amazing accomplishments of the 30 years of Mao's government, which I've already addressed, and which, to be honest with you, I didn't know any of this until about a month ago when I started doing this research. China's post-liberation history lesson in Western media and textbooks, it all gets boiled down to these three events. You know, well, maybe five if you want to. You know, liberation, 49, Korean War, Great Leap Forward, Cultural Revolution, Tiananmen Square, end of history lesson. To say that Mao, as an alternative media guru, James Corbett, who's actually quite famous in his milieu, he said in a program on his radio program, April 21st, that Mao was a disgusting, this is a quote, was a disgusting, horrible, cruel, perverse person, probably the greatest mass murderer in the history of the world. I mean, quite frankly, that is reckless, irresponsible, hyperbolic hysteria, and gross disinformation. What the West wants to deflect and deny is that Africans, Asians, and the blood keeps filling on the streets in Iraq, Syria, Palestine, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Libya, Nigeria, Mali, Sudan, Ukraine, and now Yemen, 21st century massacres and war crimes, all perpetrated and paid for by Washington, London, and Paris. This is what we don't want to accept. I've only read of three modern world leaders who drew up hit lists to kill undesirables, and they are Hitler, we know about, Stalin, and guess who? Barack Obama. That's right. Every Tuesday morning, America's president sits down with the CIA, the NSA, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff to decide who to drone and kill over the next 7 days. It was not Mao Zedong who was quoted as saying, "I'm really good at killing people." No, it was Nobel Peace Prize winner, U.S. President Barack Obama, who proudly bragged this fact, as reported in the book, Double Down. So to wrap up, overall, Mao transformed China from a backward 19th century Western and Japanese colony into a modern 20th century agricultural and industrial powerhouse, totally independent of Western hegemony, and he did all this in a span of only 30 years, setting the stage for the economic miracles and continued political and economic independence of the Deng Xiaoping era, starting in 1978-79, and from my perspective, 2013, which is now the start of the age of the Xi Jinping era. Instead of finding demons in disgust in Mao's secondary failures, Westerners only need to look in the mirror to see all the cruelty and perversions being perpetrated across the world today in real time by our governments. Have a wonderful May Day weekend, and hope you enjoyed the show.